Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. We have arrived at an interesting turning point in this country. This year, for the first time, the college-educated workforce will be made up of more women than men. The majority is only by a tiny bit, but its impact could be significant. And as the trend presumably continues, there will be more and more pressure on companies to accommodate this workforce. That is for the good of all workers. But we're not in a place of workplace equality Shangri-La just yet, because pay gaps and ceilings on advancement still exist. Those problems are there. But could that change too? This hour on Point, how women are changing the college-educated workforce. And you can join us. Are you already seeing changes in your workplace as a result of this trend? And what do you think isn't changing no matter how many women enter the workforce? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Well, joining me now from Washington is Nicole Smith. She's chief economist at Georgetown University Center on Education and the Workforce. Nicole, welcome to On Point.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Also joining us today is Ariane Hegovich, Program Director of Employment and Earnings at the Institute for Women's Policy Research. Ariane, welcome to you.
Hello, thanks for including me.
It's good to have both of you. Nicole, let me start with you first of all. Do you see this slight tipping point that we have reached regarding women and the college-educated workforce overall as a good thing?
Absolutely. It's actually not very surprising given the trends that have occurred over the last 30 or 40 years. Back in the 70s, women were 61% of all the associate's degrees that graduated. In the 80s, over 57% of BAs. And in 2000s, you know, even surpassed the number of doctoral graduates. So it was only a matter of time before we saw those graduation rates being reflected in what's happening in the workforce.
Mm. And Ariane, same question to you.
I fully agree with Nicole. In a way, what is the interesting part here is that it took so long, given that women for 30 years have been more likely to get university degrees. But hopefully it will make more of an impact on the workforce as we keep going.
Interesting. Okay, so tell me a little bit about why you think it has taken so long. Because overall, just to provide a couple of other numbers here, when you look at the workforce overall, not just college-educated workforce, but the whole American labor market, women are about 46.6%. That's according to the Wall Street Journal, some numbers that we've got here. But again, in that college-educated workforce portion, we're seeing that slight tip above 50%. But Ariane, back to that question, why did it take so long to see the number of degrees women were getting translated into the actual workforce?
I think there are two issues. One is if you have a degree, you have a higher incentive to work, right? So it makes sense that women who have college education are more likely to be in the workforce than some other women. But the other issue is it's hard to be a parent and a woman, and just because you have a college degree doesn't mean that automatically all those pressures go away. And so really, we're still struggling with that issue. And over the same period, you know, the jobs, which are mainly held by college-educated people, hours of work have grown a lot. So it's become even harder in some of the top jobs to have a kind of family life and work.
I see. And Nicole, your thoughts on that?
Well, all of that's true. But right now, in 2019, we've reached a tipping point where almost 50% of women of childbearing age are choosing to no longer have children. So we have a situation where our population is aging. Women are making decisions about their own fertility and their own child-rearing opportunities that, you know, stand independently of what's going on with their own personal relationships. So we really see a lot of independence now in terms of what women are doing, which gives them an opportunity to make their own decisions and go to the marketplace and work if they want to. And I totally agree with Ariane that, you know, despite all of these changes, women are the primary caregivers in the homes, the primary caregivers of our children, and not only children, but also elderly relatives and our mothers and our fathers and our grandparents in the home. So that responsibility from a social and a cultural basis still falls predominantly on women.
I see. Well, let's sort of drill down a little bit into different sectors here, because, of course, when we say the college-educated workforce, that's a lot of different kinds of work here. So Nicole, I mean, there are several areas, I'm thinking, you know, nursing, teaching, et cetera, where women have long been the majority of the workforce there. But are there other places now that we're seeing college-educated women tipping into the majority that we hadn't before?
Well, there are a few examples. And if you look in the medical field, there are some examples that in subdivisions you see this. So if you pediatricians are predominantly women now compared to what they were in the past. Obstetricians tend to be women. But one concern I have about all of this, Megan, is despite the fact that we've seen so much progress in and opportunities and where women, you know, have penetrated certain types of occupations that they haven't in the past, we still in 2019 face severe occupational segregation. Mm. And the example you gave of teachers and nurses, I mean, 89% of all our nurses today are still women. All our registered nurses are still women.
89%. Nicole,
yes.
Okay. Go
89%.
Ahead.
And, you know, what's always interesting when I raise this is although 89% are women, male nurses still get paid more than women nurses. So those 11% still get paid more. So a question we often have with some of my colleagues is which comes first? Is it the chicken or the egg? Is it that occupations that are predominantly women or predominantly female get paid less? Or is it when women enter into these occupations that there is a feel that women will accept lower wages, so maybe they're going to get paid less for those occupations? And we haven't really been able to come up with an actual answer to that. But the evidence, there's certainly high correlations between the percentage of women in occupations and the likelihood that they will be paid less than the average for those occupations.
Ariana, I'll come back to you in just a second. But Nicole, let's stick with this nursing example for a little bit more, because it's really interesting. I mean, when you have almost 90% of the nursing workforce being women, and yet still there is a pay gap there between men and women, I mean, what have we been able to determine about why that is in nursing right now?
Well, when you look under the hood, you see that some of this just has to do with the physicality of the competencies required for the job. So the proportion of psychiatric nurses, or people who go in psychiatric care, where you might actually have to physically restrain an individual, those percentages there are much more likely to be men than women. If you look at triage and ER, you know, and emergency care, they're much more likely to be men. The nurses, the registered nurses who are advanced practice registered nurses with master's degrees, who also get paid more, are disproportionately men as well. So, you know, we often tell people, if you want to know where the pockets of higher paid subcategories of an occupation are, just figure out where the boys are, because they definitely chase the money. Mm.
Well, actually, on this issue of nursing specifically, let's go to Jennifer, who's calling from Boston, Massachusetts. Jennifer, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. I mean, I've found I'm actually an advanced practice psychiatric nurse. And in general, like in psychiatric nursing, there are more men compared to other nurses. But male nurses with less experience and lower levels of education get the same pay or higher as female nurses doing the same job description, and sometimes even more heavier workload or higher responsibility. And I've seen this over and over again in my work.
So even
including one university I worked for did that.
Even when the education level is less for the men, they're getting paid more for the same job?
Yes.
Wow.
But, and, you know, I worked in a university where they told us we were paid based on experience and education. And a coworker of mine had left the university for a while. And when she came back, and she had a total of 8 years experience under her belt and was going to be supervising other people, her pay went up only by $1 per hour. But a new graduate nurse who didn't have any experience working before becoming advanced practice nurse, he got the same pay and better benefits.
Mm. Well, Jennifer, thank you for your call. So, Ariane, let me turn back to you on this. Is there a mirror image problem to regarding what Jennifer's saying? Like, for example, women may frequently try to get advanced degrees to achieve the same amount of pay that men are getting who have less education?
In the economy overall, that certainly is the case. So in the jobs that women work in, you have to typically get more education. You know, it's like credentialing. You have to show that you can do it. And as a man, we compared how much education you need typically as a woman to get to the same level of pay as a man, and basically to lift a family of two out of poverty. For women, you need an BA degree, and for men, if you work in the right field, you can still do it with a high school diploma and an apprenticeship. So overall, the labor market is really biased against women.
And what about, this issue of that we explored in nursing is making me wonder, Ariane, do you have the same concerns about sort of the quality of jobs available to some college-educated women?
Yes. I mean, we have been doing quite a lot, like everybody else, trying to gaze at the future and figure out what's going to happen. And typically the jobs that won't be automated require thinking and planning. And, you know, typically your creativity, you're better placed if you have a graduate degree. But if you are a teacher, post-secondary teacher, it's full of adjuncts. You can't get a full-time good jobs anymore, and you probably need a PhD to work those jobs.
Wow. Well, we are talking this hour about the fact that in 2019, women are becoming the majority of the college-educated workforce. And we want to know if you're seeing the effects of that change where you are, where you work, maybe in accounting, maybe in the law. What has changed and what still needs to be worked on? We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about something interesting that's happening in 2019, and that is the fact that this year, women become the majority of the college-educated workforce in America. Now, ostensibly, that could bring some pretty good changes to the American workplace, but also some challenges continue to persist. So we want to know what you're seeing in your workplace. If you've seen a growth in the number of college-educated women there, what has changed for the better? What hasn't changed? We're joined today by Nicole Smith. She's chief economist at the Georgetown University Center on Education and the Workforce. Ariane Hegovich also joins us. She's program director of employment and earnings at the Institute for Women's Policy Research. Now, Ariane and Nicole, I promise that we're going to talk about sort of the positive changes that can come along with this transformation of the workforce. But I got to keep it real here for another couple of minutes. And let's talk more about that persistent pay gap, because I'm seeing evidence here that not only do pay gaps still exist across the board, regardless of a woman's education level, but that in fact there seems to be some evidence that the more educated a woman becomes, the pay gap actually grows between her and her similarly educated male counterparts. Ariane, is that true?
Unfortunately, it's true. I mean, what I should say is it still is a good investment to have a degree, right? Unless you can do a very good apprenticeship. But to have a degree, you earn more, but you don't earn as much as a guy. And the problem is, you know, partly it's discrimination in the job, but you may not get hired. to the same high-performing firm, and you may not get promotions as much as a similar man. And, you know, bias may creep into the performance assessment that you get. So one thing that all those women who have are now in academia have pushed is much more research on the type of biases and to try to develop trainings and really increase awareness of all the type of issues that flow in that really have nothing to do with performance but lead to a wage gap.
Mm, I mean, at the advanced degree level, for example, it seems like the gap can be, I don't know, 20-30% even.
So I have some numbers for you.
Yeah, please do, Nicole. Yeah,
a woman with a bachelor's degree, on average, can make almost $30,000 less per year than a man with a bachelor's degree. For professional degrees like lawyers, that's up to $40,000. Huh. And PhDs, unfortunately, like myself, it's about $20,000. So it's not necessarily, you know, 100% increase with more education, but at the end of the day, it's somewhere between $20,000, $30,000, or $40,000 difference per year between a man and a woman who is equivalently qualified. And if you are sub BA, anywhere between $20,000 and $40,000 for some people with high school diploma and above. So at the end of the day, these are significant differences that can accumulate over time for women, for families, for women who are heads of households. This has a lot to do with the types of degrees that women pursue, the types of jobs they're in. But there is a significant portion of that that's also discrimination. Mm. And something that Ariane raised about people's perception about women. We all know that the very first salary you get could be the platform upon which all your other salaries are based. So you might go in there, and even if you get a raise, it's 5% or 10%. 10% of your base. Mm-hmm. If you start off at a lower number, then even if you get that increase, you will always be running a losing battle because you're never actually going to make exactly what your male counterparts make. And personality-wise, we've done research on what types of personality. I mean, there's a lot of socio-cultural perceptions and behaviors that also influence this. Women who are extremely aggressive or conscientious or asking for what they think they deserve are often looked upon in an unfavorable manner and you know, might be shooting themselves in the foot in terms of getting that opportunity, with a male counterpart doing exactly the same thing, asking for exactly the same raise, would be looked at as a go-getter. Yeah. So there's still lots of differences in perceptions of what is a woman's place and how she should approach her boss or her director for that raise that she deserves.
I am 100% shaking my head in affirmation based on personal experience. Nicole, look, I have a clear memory of my first job when I asked for a little bit more, being told, you should feel lucky that we offered you what we did. So I didn't feel lucky, for the record. I did not. But also, I want to slice these numbers a little more deeply also as well, because we're talking about numbers in aggregate. But when we speak about women of color, the differences are even bigger, aren't they?
Absolutely. So let me give you some numbers. Today, if we use the Census Bureau's most recent estimates of the gender wage gap, on average, it's 82 cents on a dollar between women and men. But for Latina women, it's 54 cents on the dollar. Mm. For Black women, it's 62 cents on the dollar compared to what a white man makes. For white women, it's 79 cents on the dollar. And for Asian women, it's 90 cents on the dollar. And that's what averages off to the 82%. So depending on race, you can see extremely significant disparities in the pay gap. And that's important.
Interesting. Go ahead, Ariane.
To some extent, those gaps reflect differences in educational attainment. So Asian women, for example, are the group who are most likely to have college degrees. But what you find is, even if you compare just women with college degrees, there are and women and men with college degrees, there's real racial hierarchies in pay. And to some extent, there's this, you know, if you think Black women may work as social workers. It's a big occupation. It's an occupation which is notoriously underpaid, and you often need a master's degree to work there. So, you know, it's this issue of occupational segregation and the fact that we really don't value those type of jobs where a lot of women work.
Well, let's go to Whitney, who's calling from Tampa, Florida. Whitney, you're on the air.
Mm-hmm. Hello, how are you?
Well, Whitney, what's your thought?
So I was, I agree with everything that you've been talking about, and my comment was actually sparked off of one of the prior callers about the female employee in the hospital who made less money having 8 years of experience versus the new graduate male for the same position. I feel like some of it, not all of it, but some of the contributing factors come down to more of a societal, cultural viewpoint of how we're even raised. For example, men being the, you know, rough, tough, usually more of a stronger personality, and the women not as much. So when we go in, especially initially to these job interviews, and we're trying to negotiate for pay, I feel that men have a bit more of an advantage, of an upper hand, because society almost kind of preps men to handle those types of situations a little bit better. Not in all cases, but just in a lot of cases. I feel that women can be a little more timid and accepting of what comes their way sometimes. So I feel like that does play some role in that.
Right. Whitney, thank you for your call. And Ariane, let me turn to you. I want to take Whitney's comment a step further here, because, yes, you could talk about sort of how women and men are socialized differently. But I think, I believe I've read several studies that show that even when women do ask for more in negotiations, the manner in which they ask for it really makes a big difference, right? If they sort of do it in a conventional way and say, well, I feel like I deserve X because look at my background, sometimes they're not as successful as if they sort of couch it in collaborative terms. And so is there sort of a gender difference even there?
Yes, I think this is exactly what Nicole was getting at. We are telling women you have to negotiate more. You basically have to be like a guy, right? The men are the models. And if women behave like that, they are not valued in the same way. It's seen as something that is not feminine, you know, and therefore you're penalized for it. So there are some studies to say even if women ask more, then, you know, you also get rejected more. But I do think the kind of advice for preparing a discussion with your supervisor about saying, I think I should gain more. The advice to everybody is always to think through what can I contribute, think through about the kind of goals and pressures on the person who you're trying to convince to give you a raise, to be collaborative and to, you know, say, this is what I can deliver, and I think you will benefit as well as I, and it's fair. So, you know, to be collaborative is always good in negotiations, at least initially, I guess.
Well, Ariane and Nicole, hang on here for just a second, because I want to bring into the conversation now George Bue. He's joining us from Fort Lauderdale, Florida. George is Vice President of Human Resources at the real estate and construction firm Stiles Corporation. He's also an expert panelist at the Society for Human Resource Management. George Bue, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. I'm glad to contribute to this important conversation.
So first of all, tell us if you've seen a difference in your field or even in your company specifically as time has marched on and more college-educated women are entering the workforce.
For sure, the pool is larger. And so we have more to choose from. And from an HR perspective, you always want to have that cohort of candidates, because it's challenging to find good talent in the workforce. And to have any kind of bias towards not having women in the workforce is really not good for business, because the talent pool is smaller. But I will share that part of the challenge is that in some areas of the business, in certain industries, the pool is smaller. Case in point, we happen to do commercial real estate development and construction. Mm-hmm. In those particular areas, it's hard to find candidates, women candidates, for us to hire, only because you don't have too many women that go into those fields. Contrary to that, is our in our accounting divisions and within our property management division, where you have women that are more interested in those fields, it's a much larger candidate pool. And indeed, when we look at the divisions as to the demographics of it, we do find that in property management accounting, the majority are women. In construction development, the majority are men. And we truly do make an effort to try to bring more diversity across the board, not just women, but even from a racial perspective, different ethnicities. Mm-hmm. Because within the HR world, it's acknowledged that diversity of thought is valuable. Yeah. To making decisions and for the company.
Now, George, has your company sort of changed HR practices or benefits packages or things like that in the workplace as you're trying to recruit and retain more women?
We're fortunate that we have always had a family culture, and by that I mean that first of all, it's a privately held organization,
right.
And the culture has always been one of really caring for the individual. So it makes my job easier. But also that culture is something that is found attractive to candidates of either gender, and a lot of it happens to be because we are flexible with our scheduling when the an employee who's a female goes and wants to raise a family, for example, we're quite flexible with our FMLA policies, with our leave policies, to try to accommodate the employee to be able to attend to the family.
Okay. So, Nicole Smith, let me turn back to you here for a moment, because this is where we get to sort of the potential for positive change. Because as more and more, as college-educated women become an increasing majority in the workforce, I presume that they're looking for the things that all workers are looking for, but perhaps they have more leverage to ask for them, right? Like more flex time, better leave policies, things like that. Do you believe that those changes can come faster as more college-educated women, as the majority becomes larger?
So absolutely, and we have seen evidence in some companies, and you know those companies are often regarded as some of the best companies to work for, are the ones that are making changes that accommodate their entire population of workers. So I could think of a few companies in the STEM field that have done things to accommodate their female workers. They have created daycare facilities, gym facilities, the types of things that women might be interested in, to ensure tenure and longevity in that particular occupation. From the perspective of the company as well, it can be very expensive to continue to have to attract new workers, to continue to, create the job ad and post the job ad and train that particular person for that field and make them, available to do the skills for your particular firm. So it becomes expensive for them. So in order to ensure that there's interest in staying and you don't sort of lose that capital, a lot of firms are actually trying to sweeten the pot to make sure that women, stay longer with them and they don't lose that due to turnover.
Yeah. And Ariane, are younger college-educated women feeling more empowered in terms of being clear about what kind of workplace they're looking for?
You know, what's really interesting is that both younger college-educated women and men are very clear about their expectations of the workplaces, that they want to have more flexibility and more work-life balance. They expect to have a partnership and, not being no longer a young college-educated woman, I'm a little more kind of jarred or cynical. But because often what happens when you then get to the you know, late 20s, early 30s, when there is this kind of rocket fuel phase where you're meant to advance. That's also when people want to have kids, if they do. And often what happens is that then it becomes much harder for couples to keep up with that wish for greater equality. So I do think the younger generation has more demands, but I also think the big challenge is to enable men to be more, do more of the caregiving work. We really can't just change for women. It has to go both ways.
Right. Well, we are talking this hour about the fact that in 2019, women become the majority, even if it's a slight majority, the majority of the college-educated workforce in America, and what changes that might bring. We want to hear from you about what you're already seeing in your workplace. We will be right back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about how the American workplace might change as women become the majority of the college-educated workforce in this country. Now, just sometimes there are joyful little moments at work, and sometimes they are very, very public, such as yesterday during a live studio broadcast on NBC News, where NBC News correspondent Courtney Kubi was talking about Turkish airstrikes in northern Syria. Not necessarily a joyful topic at all, but on camera, as she was talking about this, she was disrupted a little bit by her young son, who she had brought to work that day.
Their concern is that they want to have a Kurdish. Excuse me, my kids are here, live television. They want to have. They want to have some sort of an area where the Kurdish forces that are in Syria, in northern Syria, who Turkey sees as a real threat.
Well, they had moved to a map of Syria, as I'm sure someone was trying to gently and lovingly usher Courtney Kubi's young son off the set there. But I'm joined today by Nicole Smith. She's chief economist at the Georgetown University Center on Education and the Workforce. I'm also joined by Ariane Hegovich. She is program director of the Employment and Earnings at the Institute for Women's Policy Research. And George Bue is with us. He's with us from Fort Lauderdale, Florida. He's vice president of human resources at a real estate and construction firm, Stiles Corporation. Now, George, let me ask you, do you have some some experience within your own firm about women in senior management positions? Like, for example, your vice president of marketing at your firm is a woman, right? And has she been with the company for a long time?
She's been with us for about 12 years, and she came in actually as a communications marketing specialist, and then went through the ranks and became the vice president.
But she was able to rise through the ranks in the company.
Right, and she's actually a good example of someone who, it's interesting you had that little clip before, because when I interviewed her about, I'm going to say like 12 years ago, she had taken some time off for maternity, and she was coming back into the workforce. And in the course of the conversation, her younger daughter started to cry, and she felt a little, Adrian is her name, felt a little embarrassed. And I said, don't worry about it. It's okay. Why don't you attend to your baby and call me back when when she's comforted. And she called me back about a half hour later, and that interview was very meaningful to her because we when she called back, I mentioned that I have two daughters as well, and we got into the topic of families. And it was meaningful enough to her that she, to this day, remembers that story. And it was something that it was genuine because we, in my company, we really do care about the individuals, and I think partly also because I'm a dad, that I know what it's like, especially for women that are trying to raise a family while at the same time have a professional career. Mm-hmm. It's not easy. It's not easy. Yeah. You have to juggle it. And so that one was meaningful. And yes, she's the vice president now. She'll be listening in on this talk show.
Well, Nicole Smith, let me turn to you on this because, you know, we can talk about women being the majority or slight majority of the college-educated workforce. But again, I think when you take a microscope to where the women are working and how their careers are developing, it's a less rosy picture because, you know, Georgia's VP notwithstanding, we're not seeing that same sort of transformation of women in senior leadership positions, senior management positions, are we?
Absolutely. And you know, when you look at the numbers, just as an example, only about a quarter of our CEOs are women. Some of the power players and the decision makers, 44% of our practicing attorneys are women, but 85% of our paralegals are women. Research analysts tend to be disproportionately women. If you know, something that George raised about looking at the pool of available candidates, if you think of our engineers, in 1970, only 1% of engineers were women. Today, it's 17%. Mm. From a positive perspective, you can say, well, okay, we have increased this number, you know, by several hundred percentage points, but it's still less than 1 in 5 women are engineers. And even when women are engineers, they tend to self-segregate into environmental, industrial engineering fields, which are, you know, tend to be the lower paid fields. So part of the issue is even when women have increased the number of college degrees that they get, even when we have a dominance in the college-educated workforce, where you are matters, mm-hmm. and what position you are in, and therefore your strength and opportunity to negotiate matters. And if women are not in those positions of power, then also that has it makes it much more difficult for women to break that glass ceiling.
So, Ariane, am I just being impatient here? Will this momentum in terms of women with college educations carry forward over the next 5, 10, 15 years into senior management?
I think we should all be much more impatient, given that, you know, this story that almost at the intake, it's 50-50 men, women. And then if you look 20 years on, suddenly it's only 1 in 5, or even if we're lucky, 1 in 3. I mean, it's been going on for 30 years. So I do think it deserves a big new push. But I'm quite optimistic because I think this generation is pushy, the ones that are coming up. Although I do think we can't just focus on women. It has to be focused on women and men. And, you know, a lot of it is around caregiving, because mm-hmm. even if you make it very easy for women to work flexibly and have leave, come back when they can, if it's only women and the guys don't do it, you know, that you keep the bifurcation and it will be something nice you do to women. So it has to really come from both sides.
Nicole, let me just be utterly frank here. You told our producer prior to the show that you think a lot of these inequities will retire with the boomers. And all due respect to boomers, tell me more about that.
You have to be really careful how you quote me, since I work with many boomers. I'm just kidding.
So do I. So that's all due respect.
But I actually said it in a joking fashion. But some of these sociocultural biases and beliefs of you know, where a woman's place is, and even thinking of women's wages as the extra wage and not necessarily the, you know, the money that's going to be taking care of the entire household. Some of these perceptions are really aged and have to do with people's notions of what a woman's place is and what's going. So I think when I said to your producer that it's going to retire with the baby boomers, it's really in keeping with some of the things that Ariane has said about millennials and what are their expectations and exactly how they work today and how, you know, they view the world much differently than we have in the past. And what this means is that, you know, people are going to demand much more equality in terms of gender and not just sex. We've just been talking about sex differences here, male and female, mm-hmm. but even gender equality across the board, LGBT and all of the other variations that go with that. And something that I think is interesting is the administration earlier this year tried to remove a 2016 rule that required that larger companies report wage differentials by gender and sex to EEOC. And that was actually struck down by a judge. So knowledge is power. And if women actually know what those disparities are, how much are you making less than an equivalently qualified male? That's the only way you're going to be able to take that to, you know, take it to task and make sure that that you're paid on par. And if you don't have that information, and if it's not transparent so that we could make the comparisons, and the callers who made the comparisons for nurses or accountants, then, you know, the gender wage gap will never really diminish.
Well, let's go back to our callers here. Devin's calling from Warren, Rhode Island. Devin, you're on the air.
Yes, ma'am. Hi, how y'all doing?
Very well. Go ahead.
I agree, especially with the last point that your guest made, that if people have more transparency, if companies are more transparent about what people are getting paid and how those numbers are determined, then all workers, not just women, but all workers will be able to argue for better wages and be in a better protected position. And I kind of wonder how much it's difficult to get answers a lot of times about gender pay gap and gender pay disparities. And I think to some extent, all companies everywhere work to get the most work for the least pay out of everybody. So I'm wondering how much protections, federal protections or unions or just increased worker protections would help both men and women, you know, like mm-hmm. a rising tide lift all boats.
Right. Devin, thank you for that question. Ariane, would you like to answer him?
Yes, directly what I would say. You know, we know if you just look at the wage gap, we know in those sectors, either whether they're unions or in the public sector, where there is more transparency, both about how much you're being paid for your position and what it takes to get to the next position and what decisions you make when you recruit people, that the wage gap is lower there. So I definitely think that transparency helps, but that it helps to, you know, to have structures and accountability at work, including over how much you're paid and who is getting certain positions. And I think you were saying, you know, can we add in some positive views? I think we kind of focus on aggregates like the wage gap or women's underrepresentation in management and so on. But there are companies that are doing well, and there are companies that don't have a wage gap uh-huh. and companies that have more women in senior management positions, that have women CEOs, and they are profitable, right? So you can see that it's not inevitable. You know, change is possible, yeah. and we have to push. If we just sit back and wait, I don't think anything will change much.
George Bouet, on the thought that Ariane just shared with us, I mean, your company that you work for is family owned, right? It's not a publicly owned company.
Correct.
And has historically long had, because of that, it's had pretty family friendly policies. But I'm just wondering, in conversations with your fellow HR managers out there in the bigger HR world, we've been talking this hour about how, you know, all the evidence and the studies and the empirical evidence that exists that when you make workplaces more family friendly, bring more women into management positions, that it's good for business. You even said that. But what is stopping? What do you think is still stopping or making it hard for other companies to quickly make those changes?
Well, I think part of it is legacy, and to I think it was Ariane who made a point before about the boomers and the cultural biases that still exist in some companies. I think that does have some influence. The better run companies understand the basics of fair pay and not having any kind of policies for compensation or benefits or otherwise that will favor any one particular group. At the end of the day, it just makes good business sense to treat everyone equally. And that's what women and college-educated women in the workforce, actually all women, all everyone, wants to just be treated equally within the organization and want to be treated fairly. So going by that as a principle, it just makes good business sense. And if you follow that guideline of just being fair to everyone, it works, because in this day and age with social media, everybody gets to understand who the best employers are. Kind of, if you look at a Glassdoor, which is a Yelp type of thing.
That's right.
For employers, you can find out about companies. So it behooves organizations to do the right thing for everyone, and the word will get out. But there are those legacy challenges with some companies. I don't think I would offer not the better run companies. The larger companies, they understand this, and they'll do what is best for getting the best talent and also retaining the best talent.
Well, George Bouet, Vice President of Human Resources for the Stiles Corporation, a real estate and construction firm in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. George, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been my pleasure.
Nicole, let me ask both you and Ariane one last question here, kind of getting us back down to current day realities. We have a comment that's come in from someone calling themselves Smack Cat, I guess, who says, let's face it, companies want to pay as little as possible. So hiring women whom they don't have to pay as well as men makes sense to their business plans. What do you think about that, Nicole?
Well, you know, people will get away with what they can get away with. And coming out of the recession of 2007, which a lot of people had, you know, termed the man session, a lot of women were hired at wages that were significantly lower than, equivalently qualified men were hired at. So the challenge here is to recognize that, you know, in so doing, you might be violating several laws and legislation, and you have to hold people's feet to the fire, and women need to recognize their worth and also, you know, be aware of how much you're being underpaid and talk about that, because if you do nothing, then there are no changes.
And Ariane Hegovich, your last thought on that?
You know, I think what is amazing is basically we assume companies are rational, right? That they do what is best for their profit. And very often they don't, because they don't have the background or they don't measure how big their turnover is because they give very bad wages and conditions, right? It just doesn't go into the pot. So I do think we need also a little bit of guidance and enforcement and really a social push to make changes.
Well, Ariane Hegovich is Program Director of Employment and Earnings at the Institute for Women's Policy Research. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
And Nicole Smith, Chief Economist at the Georgetown University Center on Education and the Workforce. Nicole, it was great to have you as well. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.